Almost immediately, the cry for a great white hope went up to redeem whiteness. All eyes turned to retired heavyweight champion James J. Jeffries. When the freely smiling Jack Johnson stepped from the Canadian-Australian liner onto the docks of Vancouver on March 9, 1909, American reporters peppered him with questions about whether he would fight Jeffries. And then they noticed the most newsworthy element of all for racist America, the champion's white wife, a former Philadelphia woman who threw in her lot with him, as newspaper readers found out in the Associated Press Dispatch. Jack Johnson's earlier heartaches with two black women had caused him to date primarily white women. Johnson loathed that no matter how colored women feel toward a man, they don't spoil him and pamper him and build up his ego. White women did, and thus they were superior partners in Johnson's version of gender racism. In actuality, some white women refuse to build up their man's ego, while some black women cater to their man's ego. But by 1909, the gender racism of the submissive white woman and the hard black woman was attracting patriarchal black men to white women, just as the gender racism of the weak black man being unable to handle the hard black woman had attracted some black women to the strong white man. And just as the gender racism of hypersexual black people, embodied in the large penis or buttocks, attracted some white people to black people, and just as the assimilationist belief that the whiter and straighter the skin and hair, the more beautiful a person was, attracted black people to light and white people. All these racist myths only hardened over the next century as Americans became better able to act on their interracial attractions in public. What did love have to do with those interracial attractions based in racist ideas? Only the couples knew. There were many interracial relationships not based in racist ideas. But how many were, and how many were not? Only the couples knew. The most famous black man in America quickly became the most hated black man in America. By 1908, Johnson had won three of the four greatest prizes of patriarchal white masculinity: wealth, the heavyweight title, and the white woman. Taft, winning the White House, hardly could calm the fury of white men, especially when Jack Johnson went on to flaunt his white woman, his wealth, and his title. If the black man wins, thousands and thousands of his ignorant brothers will misinterpret his victory as justifying claims to much more than mere physical equality with their white neighborhoods, predicted a writer in the New York Times months before the biggest sporting event in American history on July 4, 1910. It was the first to be reported live through wireless telegraphy. The former heavyweight champion, the mammoth Jim Jeffries, dubbed the Great White Hope, came out of retirement to seek the heavyweight title for the white race and win it back from the nation's most hated and beloved man, Jack Johnson. The match was held in Reno, Nevada, before 12,000 raging white spectators. Johnson knocked Jeffries out in the 15th round, sending a surge of excitement through black America and a surge of fury through racist America. Racist mobs tried to beat black bodies back down, and racist writers tried to beat black minds back down. "Do not swell your chest too much," warned the Los Angeles Times. "No man would think a bit higher of you because your complexion is the same as that of the victor in Reno." Later, in Knuckles and Gloves, 1922, London boxing aficionado John Gilbert explained that white men were at a disadvantage in boxing because of their physical inequality. The U.S. government soon accomplished what white boxers failed to do, knocking out Jack Johnson, though only in a metaphorical sense. He was arrested on trumped-up charges of transporting a prostitute, or rather a white woman, across state lines. After skipping bail, he lived abroad for 7 years before turning himself in, and then he spent almost a year in jail. With racist Americans hungry for the restoration of superior white masculinity after Johnson knocked it down and out, a pulp fiction writer served them what they needed. Edgar Rice Burroughs, who lived in Johnson's stomping ground of Chicago, had been moved by Henry Morgan Stanley's 19th century productions of Africa's Savagery. In All Story magazine in October 1912, Americans first tasted Burroughs' novel, Tarzan of the Apes. Tarzan tells the story of an orphan infant of white parents abandoned in Central Africa who is raised by the she-ape Kala in a community of apes. The orphan, John Clayton, is named Tarzan by the apes. It means white skin in their language. As he grows up, Tarzan becomes the community's most skilled hunter and warrior, more skilled than any of the nearby ape Africans. He eventually finds his parents' cabin and teaches himself to read. In subsequent stories, Tarzan protects a white woman named Jane from ravishing black men and apes all around her. Tarzan goes on to teach his children, the Africans, how to fight and grow food. It is hard to imagine a more famous fictional character during the 20th century than Tarzan, and it is hard to imagine a more racist plot than what Barrows wrote up in the Tarzan Adventure Series books, which he was writing and publishing almost up until his death in 1950. The plot became a Hollywood staple, reappearing again and again, most recently in the 2009 blockbuster Avatar. Barrows made the association between animals, savages, and Africa permanent in the American mind. The defining message of the Tarzan series was clear. Whether on Wall Street or in the forests of Central Africa, swinging through Greek literature or swinging from trees, white people will do it better than the African ape-like children, so much better that whites will always, the world over, become teachers of African people. Forget Jack Johnson's heavyweight title. White men had something better now. They had Tarzan, the instant sensation, a cultural icon for the ages, the character that inspired comic strips, merchandise, 27 sequels, and 45 motion pictures, the first appearing in 1918. W.E.B. Du Bois couldn't have cared less about Jack Johnson and boxing in 1909. He was worried about his biography of the anti-slavery activist John Brown. The darling of white liberal America, the publisher of the Evening Post and the Nation, and the grandson of William Lloyd Garrison, had also published a biography of Brown that year. Oswald Garrison Villard's biography was widely held as definitive and it sold well. Du Bois's sales were as disappointing as the reviews. Black scholars were routinely ignored by the white media and by white readers, even when they had nationally recognizable names like Du Bois. "We rated merely as Negroes studying Negroes," Du Bois recalled, and after all, what had Negroes to do with America or science? What did science have to do with the fierce fight against the Tuskegee machine and Jim Crow segregation? What, with all my dreaming, studying, and teaching, was I going to do in this fierce fight? Du Bois asked. Losing faith in scientific persuasion, he decided to lead and inspire and decide. He left Atlanta University in the summer of 1910 and moved to New York to become the founding editor of The Crisis, the organ of the recently founded National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP. At the NAACP, Du Bois butted heads with Oswald Garrison Villard, who along with Du Bois was one of the co-founders of the new organization. Like his grandfather, Villard was more of an assimilationist than an anti-racist, and he looked upon black people as social problems. Then again, while his grandfather had loved aggressive anti-racist blacks, such as early black feminist Maria Stewart, Villard naturally expected African Americans to be humble and thankful, or certainly not assertive and aggressive, Du Bois accurately noted. For instance, Villard tried unsuccessfully to push Ida B. Wells Barnett out of the committee of 40 that had been responsible for organizing the NAACP. Assimilationists and anti-racists launched the NAACP at a crucial moment. Segregationists had just launched their eugenics movement, demonstrating the progression of their racist policies and the racist ideas to justify them. Social Darwinism had fully immigrated to the United States. In 1910, former University of Chicago biologist Charles Davenport secured some financial support from a railroad heiress to establish the Eugenics Record Office at the nation's first center dedicated to improving the nation's genetic stock, the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in New York. Davenport was the son of an abolitionist and had studied at Harvard during Du Bois's tenure. Davenport sought to prove one of the most oppressive figments of the human imagination, that personality and mental traits were inherited, and that superior racial groups inherited superior traits. "So you see that the seed sown by you is still sprouting in distant countries," Davenport wrote to England's pioneering eugenicist Francis Galton, Darwin's cousin, in 1910. "And the vines of eugenics surely sprouted after 1910, watered incessantly by Davenport and the 250 eugenicists whom he trained. Permanent advance would only come about by securing the best blood, he wrote in the movement's manifesto, Heredity in Relation to Eugenics, 1911. The eugenics movement quickly rushed into American popular culture, in Better Babies contests, in magazines, in college courses, in popular lectures, and in a society assessing moguls and criminals as having good or bad genes, good or bad blood. It did not matter that people did not change after blood transfusions, nor did it matter that eugenicists never uncovered any evidence proving that heredity shaped behavior. The eugenics movement created believers, not evidence. Americans wanted to believe that the racial, ethnic, class, and gender hierarchies in the United States were natural and normal. They wanted to believe that they were passing their traits on to their children. As eugenics gained ground, Du Bois used the crisis to combat the movement and to publicize those facts and arguments which showed the danger of race prejudice. As part of that agenda, he printed a piece by Franz Boas, prepping readers for Boas's 1911 magnum opus, The Mind of Primitive Man. Boas echoed the old creed of assimilationists in The Mind of Primitive Man, rejection of the segregationist theory of hereditary inferiority, and belief that the complete loss of African cultures and the pressures of slavery and discrimination had made black people inferior. In short, there is every reason to believe that the Negro, when given facility and opportunity, will be perfectly able to fulfill the duties of citizenship as well as his white neighbor, Boas wrote. It may be that he will not produce as many great men as the white race, and that his average achievement will not quite reach the level of the average achievement of the white race, but there will be endless numbers who will be able to outrun their white competitors. North American Negroes in culture and language, Boas said, were essentially European. Boas was absolutely opposed to all kinds of attempts to foster racial solidarity, including among his own Jewish people. He, like other assimilationists, saw the United States as a melting pot in which all the cultural colors became absorbed together into white Americanness. Ironically, assimilationists like Boas hated racial solidarity, but kept producing racist ideas based on racial solidarity. Boas composed a preface for another popular book in 1911, Half a Man, The Status of the Negro in New York, by NAACP co-founder and scholar Mary White Ovington. While pointing out some racial discrimination, she put a new statistical spin on the old racist stereotype of the oversexed, irresponsible black woman. The higher the ratio of black women to men, she said, made these surplus women prone to prostitution and prone to playing havoc with their neighbors' sons, even with their neighbors' husbands. Along the same lines, social work forerunner Jane Addams alleged, in the crisis, that black mothers were less able than Italian mothers to control their girls' sexual behavior. Ida B. Wells Barnett cannot let these attacks from white women go by unchecked. Black women, she wrote, had the same love for husbands and children, the same ambitions for well-ordered families that white women have. As part of his effort to expand readership and demonstrate the capability of black folk, Du Bois unveiled a popular section in The Crisis on Black Firsts in June 1911, those individual black professionals breaking through racial barriers. As America desegregated over the next century, praises rained down on black firsts, such as hair industry mogul Madam C.J. Walker and Chicago Defender founder Robert Abbott, who became the first black millionaires. At their anti-racist best, praises for black firsts turned into demonstrations against racial discrimination and demands for black seconds and tenths and thirtieths. At their racist worst, Americans held up black firsts as extraordinary Negroes or as signposts of racial progress. As more blacks broke free from the discriminatory barriers, society could find more ways to ignore the barriers themselves and could even argue that something else was holding black people back. With every black first, the blame shifted to those black people who failed to break away. Du Bois's The Crisis tried to assign blame to both, the black have-nots and the discriminatory barriers. But accommodating black firsts advocated for a greater black work ethic as a better social policy than action against discriminatory bars. If some could break away, the logic went, then all could, if they worked hard enough. Racist logic didn't have to be logical. It just had to make common sense,
And so, as much as Black Firsts broke racial barriers, the publicity around Black Firsts sometimes, if not most times, reinforced racist ideas blaming blacks and the remaining discriminatory barriers.
By 1913, the crisis had accumulated a captivated audience. Captivated by the leadership of the talented 10th and the NAACP, captivated by popular sections of the publication, such as Black Firsts, and captivated more than anything else by the brilliant editorial pen of W.E.B. Du Bois. In March, Du Bois joined the rest of the publishing nation in reporting on the first major suffrage parade in Washington, D.C., organized by the segregated National American Women's Suffrage Association. In their march down Pennsylvania Avenue, 5,000 suffragists faced a funnel of white male policemen and hecklers. In the crisis, Du Bois reported the remarkable contrast between the nasty white male opposition and the reportedly respectful black male observers. In a rush of biting anti-assimilationist sarcasm, he asked his black male readers, "Does it not make you burn with shame to be a mere black man when such mighty deeds are done by the leaders of civilization? Does it not make you ashamed of your race? Does it not make you want to be white?" A few years later, Du Bois published a forum on women's suffrage, particularly for the black woman. Not many of the black contributors advanced the popular and sexist argument of white suffragists that women's innate childlike morality gave them a distinct entitlement to the vote. But educator Nanny H. Burroughs took this argument and refashioned it. She was one of the more articulate and hard-nosed leaders of her time. Back in 1904, Burroughs had indicted racist colorism in not color but character. There were legions of black men who would rather marry a woman for her color than her character, Burroughs charged. And so, black women went about trying to change their appearance, straightening their hair and bleaching their skin to look like white women. What every woman who straightens out needs is not her appearance changed, but her mind changed, Burroughs charged. If Negro women would use half of their time they spend on trying to get white, to get better, the race would move forward. On the suffrage issue in the crisis forum, Burroughs skipped over into racist ideas, and especially into the idea of the weak black male selling out his vote and the strong black woman not selling out hers. This gender racism had been articulated by everyone from Anna Julia Cooper to Frances Ellen Harper. W.E.B. Du Bois and Southern segregationists James K. Vardaman and Ben Pitchfork Tillman. Immoral, corrupt, and weak black men had bartered and sold the vote, Burroughs argued. The Negro woman needs the ballot to get back by the wise use of it, what the Negro man has lost by the misuse of it, Burroughs argued. In claiming that black women would not have sold out their votes, Burroughs was simultaneously rewriting history and regarding black women as politically superior to black men. She was ignoring the history of black male and female resistance to the ambush of laws, violence, and economic intimidation that forcibly stole black male voting power. Then again, Burroughs may have still been upset about that loud minority of black male voters who went for the Democrat in the 1912 presidential election. Though Woodrow Wilson, a Virginia-born Democrat, was a former Princeton political scientist who had made a name for himself conjuring up the black terrors of Reconstruction and defending the re-enslaving white South, he had secured Du Bois's vote and the votes of thousands of other black men by pledging moderation on race. Once in office, Wilson gave Southern segregationists a dominant influence in his administration, while encouraging blacks to focus on uplift suasion. W.E.B. Du Bois felt hoodwinked. An American politician had once again played black voters like a drum and forced them to hear the deadening beat of segregation in Washington, D.C. and federal offices across the South. During his first term, Wilson enjoyed the first ever film screening at the White House, and the selection was a stark symbol of his ideas about race. The 1915 film was Hollywood's first feature-length studio production, D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation, based on Thomas Dixon's popular novel, The Klansman. The film signaled the birth of Hollywood and of the motion picture industry in the United States. It became the newest visual medium by which to circulate racist ideas, eclipsing the fading minstrel shows. The silent film depicted Reconstruction as an era of corrupt black supremacists petrifying innocent whites.
At the climax, a black male rapist, played by a white actor in blackface, pursues a white woman into the woods until she leaps to her death. "Lynch him! Lynch him!" moviegoers shouted in Houston, and nearly 100 blacks were actually lynched in 1915. In the end, the victim's brother in the film organizes Klansmen to regain control of Southern society. A white Jesus, brown-haired, brown-eyed, and white-robed, appears to bless the triumph of white supremacy as the film concludes. "It is like writing history with lightning," Wilson reportedly said after the film. "And my only regret is that it is all so terribly true." Millions of white Northerners and Southerners packed movie houses beginning on February 8, 1915, to watch the widely believed truth of the Reconstruction era. By January 1916, more than 3 million people had viewed the film in New York alone. It was the nation's highest-grossing film for 2 decades, and it enabled millions of Americans to feel redeemed in their lynchings and segregation policies. The film revitalized the Ku Klux Klan, drawing millions of Americans by the 1920s into the club that terrorized Jews, immigrants, socialists, Catholics, and blacks. Angry at its terrible lies, black communities everywhere protested the birth of a nation. In the final days of his life, Booker T. Washington tried to accomplish behind the scenes what the NAACP and other civil rights groups were trying to do openly: block its showing. They failed. Du Bois took a different approach, challenging the film's historical racism in his sweeping history, The Negro, published right on time in 1915. He tore up the fairy tales of the non-African ancient Egypt, the absence of sophisticated pre-modern African states, the horrors of Reconstruction, and so on. He had seemingly dropped his biological concept of race, but he had not dropped his racist notions about the traits of the Negro, whom he termed the most lovable of men. For all the Northern activists' efforts to block the birth of a nation, or to rewrite the history it depicted, or to challenge the mass disenfranchisement of black men that it endorsed, Southern black activists did infinitely more. They protested Southern segregationists with their feet. By the time they finished, they had indeed given birth to a new nation. Chapter 25. The Birth of a Nation. War is hell, but there are things worse than hell, as every Negro knows. W.E.B. Du Bois had a knack for packaging the complex feelings of black folk into words. After World War I cut off immigration from Europe, labor recruiters from northern industries headed into southern towns searching for a new labor supply. Even if the birth of a nation had never appeared before excited southern audiences, southern blacks would probably have still been all ears to northern industrial recruiters. Then again, southern blacks did not need these recruiters to entice them to escape a place that in some ways was worse than hell. During the Great War, black people once again used their legs as activism, escaping from rural towns to southern cities, from southern cities to border state cities, and from border state cities to northern cities in what became known as the Great Migration. In the first mass anti-racist movement of the 20th century, migrants eschewed beliefs in the New South's racial progress, in the notion of Jim Crow being better than slavery, and in the claim that blacks' political economic plight was their fault. Segregationists tried to slow the migration through racist ideas. Ideas put into action when they terrorized northern labor recruiters, when they arrested migrants, and even when they tried to improve labor conditions, but nothing and no one could stop this movement. When migrants reached northern cities, they faced the same discrimination they thought they had left behind, and they heard the same racist ideas. The black and white natives of northern cities looked down on the migrants and their different, though equal, southern or rural cultural ways as culturally backward. They looked at their families as dysfunctional, and they called these migrants, who had moved hundreds of miles seeking work and a better life, lazy. In 1918, Harvard-trained historian Carter G. Woodson, who had just founded the first black history journal and professional association, correctly predicted that the maltreatment of Negroes will be nationalized. Migrants faced segregation in the northern receiving stations, as journalist Isabel Wilkerson termed them in 2010. Racist Harlemites, for instance, organized to fight off what they called a growing menace of black hordes and ended up segregating their communities. Over the course of six decades, some 6 million black Southerners left their homes, transforming black America from a primarily Southern population to a national and urban one, and segregationist ideas became nationalized and urbanized in the process. The Great Migration overshadowed a smaller migration of people from the Caribbean and Africa to the United States. A young, well-read, charismatic Jamaican with a passion for African people and an understanding of racism arrived in New York in March 1916 to raise funds for a school in Jamaica. Seeking out Du Bois, the stocky, dark-skinned Marcus Mosiah Garvey visited the New York offices of the NAACP. Du Bois was absent, and Garvey was unable to tell whether he was in a white office or that of the NAACP. The plethora of white and biracial assimilationists on the NAACP's staff and all the biracial assimilationists in leadership positions in black America no doubt contributed to Garvey's decision to remain in Harlem and build his Universal Negro Improvement Association, UNIA, there. His organizing principles were global African solidarity, the beauty of dark skin and African-American culture, and global African self-determination. Africa for the Africans, he liked to say. His UNIA quickly attracted anti-racists, black working people, and black migrants and immigrants who did not like the colorism, class racism, assimilationism, and nativism of the NAACP and the Talented Tenth. Marcus Garvey and his admirers were not the only people observing the growing population and power of biracial Americans. Scholars were taking note. 2 years after Garvey's jarring visit to the NAACP's headquarters, sociologist and eugenicist Edward Byron Reuter finished The Mulatto in the United States, 1918. From his base at the University of Iowa, Reuter made a name for himself arguing that anything black people achieved was in fact the achievement of biracial people. He situated biracial people as a sort of racial middle class, below superior whites, but above inferior full blacks, as they were called. Biracial people often rejected the racist idea of their inferiority to whites, but they consumed and reproduced the racist idea of their superiority to blacks. Reuter stamped biracial people as a peculiar people, despite their success, around the same time that homosexuals were being marked as a peculiar people. Reuter reinforced the fundamentally racist idea that biracial people were abnormal, though inferior to some and superior to others. Homosexuals, like biracial people, also were considered abnormal, and the two were sometimes considered in the same breath as peculiar people, situated in an in-between state. Between the whitest of men and the blackest Negro stretches out a vast line of intermediary races, proclaimed one of the earlier advocates of homosexual rights, Xavier Maine, in The Intersexes, 1908. Nature abhors the absolute, delights in the half-steps, the between, beings. Passing bisexuals and biracial people quietly disrupted the so-called normality of heterosexuality and racial purity. Eugenicists promoting the need for maintaining the purity of the white race endlessly berated interracial reproduction. In an explosive wartime book published in 1916 called The Passing of the Great Race, New York lawyer Madison Grant constructed a racial ethnic ladder with Nordics, the new term for Anglo-Saxons, at the top, and Jews, Italians, the Irish, Russians, and all non-whites on lower rungs. He reconstructed a world history of rising and falling civilizations based on the amount of Nordic blood in each nation. The races vary intellectually and morally just as they do physically, Grant suggested. It has taken us 50 years to learn that speaking English, wearing good clothes, and going to school and church does not transform a Negro into a white man. This segregationist passionately told assimilationists that their efforts were bound to fail. Black people were incapable of development and could not become white. Grant revised and reissued his book 3 times in 5 years, and it was translated into several foreign languages. Publishers were barely able to supply the voracious demand for segregationist ideas and for the dashing eugenicist movement as white theorists attempted to normalize the social inequities on display. When Germany surrendered in the Great War, an embittered Austrian soldier sprinted into German politics, where he gained some cheers for his nasty speeches against Marxists and Jews. In 1924, Adolf Hitler was jailed for an attempted revolution.
He used the time in prison and Madison Grant's book to write his magnum opus, Mein Kampf. The highest aim of human existence is the conservation of race, Hitler famously wrote. The Nazi Tsar later thanked Grant for writing The Passing of the Great Race, which Hitler called my Bible. Eugenicist ideas also became part of the fledgling discipline of psychology and the basis of newly minted standardized intelligence tests. Many believed these tests would prove once and for all the existence of natural racial hierarchies. In 1916, Stanford eugenicist Lewis Terman and his associates perfected the IQ test based on the dubious theory that a standardized test could actually quantify and objectively measure something as intricate and subjective and varied as intelligence across different experiential groups. The concept of general intelligence did not exist. When scholars tried to point out this mirage, it seemed to be as much in the eye of the beholder as general beauty, another non-existent phenomenon. But Terman managed to make Americans believe that something that was inherently subjective was actually objective and measurable. Terman predicted that the IQ test would show enormously significant racial differences in general intelligence, differences which cannot be wiped out by any scheme of mental culture. Standardized tests became the newest objective method of proving black intellectual inferiority and justifying discrimination, and a multi-million dollar testing industry quickly developed in schools and workplaces. IQ tests were administered to 1.75 million soldiers in 1917 and 1918. American Psychological Association president and Princeton psychologist Carl C. Brigham used the results of the Army intelligence test to conjure up a genetic, intellectual racial hierarchy. And a few years later, he constructed the SAT test for college admissions. Whites scored better, and for Brigham, that was because of their superior white blood. African Americans in the North scored better than African Americans in the South. And Brigham argued that Northern blacks had a higher concentration of white blood and that these genetically superior African Americans had sought better opportunities up north because of their greater intelligence. An armistice signed on November 11, 1918, ended the fighting in World War I. It took 6 months of negotiations at the Paris Peace Conference for colonial powers to come to an agreement on the Treaty of Versailles. W.E.B. Du Bois ventured to Paris in 1918 and sent back gripping letters and editorials to the crisis. He shared the racism faced by black soldiers, adding to the wartime press reports filled with stories of black heroism. But this storyline of black heroism changed in white newspapers to the storyline of black deficiency when the officers, who were disproportionately white and Southern, returned to the United States and began telling their own war stories to reporters. As a collection, Du Bois's Parisian dispatches and activities displayed his lingering double consciousness of assimilationism and anti-racism. Du Bois witnessed steadily fierce opposition among the victors at the Paris Peace Conference to granting independence to colonial peoples. In Reconstruction and Africa, published in the February 1919 issue of The Crisis, Du Bois rejected, in anti-racist fashion, the notion that Europe was the benevolent civilizer of Africa. He declared, white men are merely juggling with words, or worse, when they declare that the withdrawal of Europe from Africa will plunge the continent into chaos. On the other assimilationist hand, Du Bois helped organize the first Pan-African Congress that month in Paris, which called on the Paris Peace Conference to adopt gradual decolonization and civil rights. Du Bois desired a chance for peaceful and accelerated development of black folk. At long last, the party signed the Treaty of Versailles on June 28, 1919. The massive German state was forced to pay reparations. France, Belgium, South Africa, Portugal, and England received Germany's prized African colonies. The League of Nations was created to rule the world. The Wilson administration joined with England and Australia in rejecting Japan's proposal that the League's charter confess a commitment to the equality of all peoples. At least President Wilson was being honest. He feared that the relatively good treatment black soldiers had received in France had gone to their heads. To Wilson's racist Americans, there was nothing more dangerous than a self-respecting black person with anti-racist expectations of immediate equality, rather than the gradual equality of assimilationists or the permanent inequality of segregationists.
In 1919, many black soldiers returned to their towns with anti-racist expectations as new Negroes, and they were greeted by new Negroes, too. These new Negroes heeded Du Bois's plea. By the God of heaven, we are cowards and jackasses if now that the war is over, we do not marshal every ounce of our brain and brawn to fight a sterner, long, more unbending battle against the forces of hell in our own land, Du Bois wrote, and we returned fighting in the crisis of May 1919. The same U.S. Postal Service that for decades had delivered white newspapers, doused in lynching kerosene, refused to deliver this crisis, judging Du Bois's words as unquestionably violent and extremely likely to excite a considerable amount of racial prejudice, if that has not already reached its maximum amongst the Negroes. Du Bois's own false 1901 construction of anti-racists as being filled with revenge and anger against white people instead of anger against racist ideas and discrimination had finally come back to bite him. He had spent his early years urging black people to calmly focus their efforts on their own moral uplift, on uplift suasion, to change racist minds. He had tried to provide white Americans with the scientific facts of racial disparities, and he had believed that producers of racist ideas and policies could be persuaded through reason to end their production. He had spent his early years ridiculing leaders like Ida B. Wells Barnett and Bishop Henry McNeil Turner as unwise, as violent, and as prejudiced when they had passionately called on black people to fight. But every year, as the failures of education and persuasion and uplift piled up, Du Bois's urgings for black people to protest and fight became stronger and more passionate. But then he had to face the same criticism and censorship that he had dished out to others earlier in his career. After a week's delay, postal officials finally delivered the crisis. They had found there were even more dangerous anti-racist and socialist publications being edited by new Negroes, including Marcus Garvey's The Negro World. Out at those Americans still packing movie houses to watch Tarzan and the Birth of a Nation, who were still spending their afternoons reading The Passing of the Great Race or attending Klan events or trying to segregate away black migrants, respond to the new Negro? James Weldon Johnson described their response during that year of 1919 as the Red Summer for all the blood that spilled in the deadliest series of white invasions of black neighborhoods since Reconstruction. Since racist ideas were not working on new Negroes, violence came rushing forth in at least 25 U.S. cities, as if to remind the assertive new Negro of white rule. If we must die, let it not be like hogs, Claude McKay's booming poem of self-defense shouted in July. Like men, we'll face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying, but fighting back. Racist white newspapers, as was customary then as it is today, tended to depict the black victims as criminals and the white criminals as victims. Black newspapers, as was also customary after dramatic shows of self-defense, tended to play up the redemption of black masculinity. At last our men had stood like men, struck back, were no longer dumb, driven cattle, one black woman rejoiced in the crisis. For racist white commentators, the black men who supposedly instigated the Red Summer were beastly cattle. To racist black commentators, these formerly beastly cattle, by striking back, had proven themselves to be men after all. Racist ideas inflamed both sides in the Red Summer, and gender racism came out of the smoke, especially the horrible coughing silence about all those courageous black women who had defended their men and children and communities. The Wilson administration somehow conflated the Red Summer with the post-war Red Scare, blaming anti-capitalists for the carnage instead of violent white racists. On September 27, 1919, 128 alienated white socialists, inspired by the recent Russian Revolution, gathered in Chicago to form the Communist Party of the United States of America, CPUSA. The racial oppression of the Negro is simply the expression of his economic bondage and oppression, each intensifying the other, the CPUSA's program declared, sounding eerily like the founding racial program of the Socialist Party of America, SPA, in 1903. Since then, SPA leaders, such as the party's five-time presidential candidate, Eugene V. Debs, had tended to say that there was no Negro question outside of the labor question. Like their SPA predecessors,
CPUSA officials would also go on to raise capitalist exploitation over racial discrimination instead of leveling and challenging them both at once. In their incomplete reading of the world's political economy, racism emerged out of capitalism, and therefore the problem of capitalism came before the problem of racism. The communists theorized that if they killed capitalism, racism would die too, not knowing that capitalism and racism had both emerged during the same long 15th century, and that since then, they had been mutually fortifying each other while developing separately. The communists of the CPUSA admonished blacks and whites during the Red Summer to realize their misery is not due to race antagonism, but the class antagonism between big business and labor. Big business was certainly producing and reproducing racist policies and ideas to divide and conquer the working class, decrease their labor costs, and increase their political power. However, the CPUSA downplayed or ignored the ways in which white laborers and unions were discriminating against and degrading black laborers to increase their own wages, improve their own working conditions, and bolster their own political power. And why would white labor not continue ruling black labor if labor gained political and economic control over capital in the United States? The communists did not address that, nor did they address their own racist ideas during these formative years that were pointed out by the anti-racist blacks joining their ranks. In seeking to unify the working class, CPUSA leaders focused their early recruiting efforts on racist white laborers. They refused to update Karl Marx's scriptures to account for their deeply racialized nation in 1919. CPUSA officials typically stayed silent on what it might mean for the future of racism if a communist revolution took place that did not simultaneously support a revolution against racism. W.E.B. Du Bois was inspired by the red-hot summer like never before, and not just because he was excited about the new Negro, or because he started closely reading and updating Karl Marx. In February 1920, he put out the searing essays of Dark Water, Voices from Within the Veil. Du Bois had wearily come to realize that the segregationist belief that black folk are subhuman was not based on any lack of knowledge. It is simply passionate, deep-seated heritage, and as such can be moved by neither argument nor fact. In moving away from educational persuasion, Du Bois finally began to turn instead toward a singly anti-racist consciousness. But he did not quite reach it. Instead, he wrote, "European culture, is it not better than any culture that arose in Africa or Asia? It is." After damning modern African and Asian cultures, Du Bois spoke out against the damnation of women. In Dark Water, Du Bois did something for black women that was rarely done. "For their worth and their beauty and their promise and for their hard past, I honor the women of my race," he said. But in honoring the black woman, he dishonored non-black women and black men, especially in their roles as mothers and fathers. He described one global unhappy family. The father and his worship is Asia. Europe is the precocious, self-centered, forward-striving child, but the land of the mother is and was Africa, he wrote. Nowhere was a mother's love stronger and deeper than in Africa. W.E.B. Du Bois, the son of a single mother, not surprisingly declared, "It is mothers and mothers of mothers who seem to count, while fathers are shadowy memories." Du Bois followed in the long line of reformers who played up in black people what racists played down. In his case, he turned the global projection of the black woman as the immoral anti-mother, the anti-woman, into the global projection of the black woman as the moral supermother, the superwoman. But whether redeeming or degrading black women, such projections spun reality, generalizing the behavior of immoral individuals or motherly individuals, and in the process propagating racist ideas. An anti-racist sketch of black women would have depicted the same diversity of motherly and unmotherly behavior found in all equally imperfect female racial groups. For decades, diverse sketches of black feminine behavior had swayed heads and hips, minds and hearts, in buoyant juke joints. Months after the release of Du Bois' Dark Water, Mamie Robison brought out the first recording of the great anti-racist art form of the 1920s. Crazy Blues became a bestseller. Record companies capitalized on the blues craze among black and white listeners alike. Robison, Ma Rainey, Ida Cox and Bessie Smith sang about black women as depressed and happy, as settling down and running around, as hating and loving men, as gullible and manipulative, as sexually free and sexually conforming, as assertive and passive, as migrating and staying, as angels and as wild women. Blues women and their male counterparts embraced African-American cultural ways, despised the strategy of trying to persuade whites that blacks were okay, and were therefore despised by talented 10th assimilationists. For all its assimilationist ideas, Du Bois's Dark Water, Voices from Within the Veil, was still too well spiced with anti-racism for the bland tastes of racist readers. Northern, Southern, and foreign racist reviewers almost unanimously condemned the book as a bitter, madman's hymn of racial hate, or what the Southerner would write if he turned Negro, as the socialist Harold Lasky of the London School of Economics put it. Meanwhile, the overwhelming response of black readers, including the legions of common sharecroppers and domestics, was that it was a milestone in the history of the Negro race, as the Washington Bee attested. Some anti-racist new Negroes did not like some of the bland moralizing and class racism of Dark Water. Yale alumnus William Ferris, the editor of Garvey's The Negro World, said Du Bois looked down on the black masses and their ailments from the heights of his own greatness. It was a charge hardly anyone could deny, especially after Du Bois's views on Marcus Garvey became known. Garvey's movement would collapse in a short time, Du Bois had allegedly said, and his followers are the lowest type of Negroes, mostly from the West Indies. The reporter who published this quotation, exhibiting class and ethnic racism, probably caught Du Bois in a rancorous mood that August 1920. All month long, Du Bois had had to watch and listen to the massive parades and meetings of the First International Convention of Garvey's UNIA. "We shall now organize the 400 million Negroes of the world into a vast organization to plant the banner of freedom on the great continent of Africa," Garvey had blared on August 2, 1920, to the UNIA convention's 25,000 enraptured delegates at Madison Square Garden. The bombastic convention left the activist African world in wondrous awe for months. Du Bois and the talented 10th, however, felt deeply threatened by Garvey's exposure of the touchy reality of light-skinned privilege. "Garvey is an extraordinary leader of men," Du Bois admitted in the crisis at the end of 1920. But it had been a mistake for him to try to bring Caribbean color politics to the United States. "American Negroes recognize no color line in or out of the race," Du Bois said, "and they will in the end punish the man who attempts to establish it." It was probably the silliest statement of Du Bois's serious career. He sounded as oblivious as the colorblind racists who had angered him for decades by discounting the existence of the racial line. In denying the color line, Du Bois discounted the existence of color discrimination, in effect blaming darker blacks for their disproportionate poverty. Du Bois had eyes. He knew light skins dominated the most desirable political and economic positions available to blacks. In his own talented 10th essay in 1903, he had mentioned 21 present and past black leaders, and all of them except Phyllis Wheatley had been biracial. No Ida B. Wells Barnett or Callie House appeared. He probably heard the circulating black children's rhyme, "If you're white, you're right. If you're yellow, you're mellow. If you're brown, stick around. If you're black, get back." Du Bois knew that elite, light-skinned folks were still using brown paper bags and rulers to bar dark-skinned folks from churches, jobs, civic groups, historically black colleges, black fraternities and sororities, and even neighborhoods and other types of gatherings. Du Bois was probably not oblivious. More likely, he and his light-skinned peers felt their color privilege was threatened by discussions of colorism and color equality. Not unlike whites who felt their racial privilege threatened by discussions of racism and racial equality. And so Du Bois copied his enemies. He used racist ideas and his punishing power to silence the anti-racist challenge to color discrimination. The conflict between Du Bois and Garvey reached its peak in the early 1920s, when they sparred over the question of racial mixing. In October 1921, President Warren G. Harding went to Birmingham to hunt up Southern support, and he insisted that racial amalgamation there cannot be. While the crisis reprimanded Harding for rejecting interracial relations, Garvey hailed the president for his endorsement of racial separatism.
In contrast to Madison Grant's eugenicists, who were advocating white racial purity and opposing interracial reproduction due to the intrusion of inferior black blood, Garvey advocated black racial purity, opposing interracial reproduction due to the intrusion of different white blood. Assimilationists often erroneously confused Garvey's separatists, who actually believed in separate but equal, with segregationists, who really believed in separate but unequal. It was Garvey's assimilationist opponents who were constructing black integration into white spaces as progress. And these assimilationists also were conjoining Garvey's separatist efforts of racial solidarity with segregationist efforts to maintain the racial exclusion of inferior peoples. Garvey's assimilationist opponents failed to realize that there was nothing inherently tolerant or intolerant about Americans voluntarily separating themselves or integrating themselves. Americans routinely did separate and integrate themselves voluntarily based on religion, gender, ethnicity, sexuality, profession, class, race, and social interests. Separatist organizing can be racist, and when it is, it turns into segregation, if the emphasis is on excluding inferior peoples. Interracial organizing can be racist, and when it is, it turns into assimilation, if the emphasis is on elevating inferior blacks by putting them under the auspices of superior whites. That was Garvey's somewhat false impression of the interracial program of the NAACP. Du Bois and Garvey represented a larger and nastier battle within black America among assimilationists, anti-racists, and separatists, between the classes, between natives and West Indians, between nationalists and Pan-Africanists, and between light skins and dark skins. But Garvey had a much bigger enemy trying to silence him, the U.S. government. In June 1923, he was convicted of mail fraud. Out on bail, he ventured to Liberia, as did Du Bois. Upon his return, Du Bois's anger and sense of privilege got the better of him when in May 1924, he called Garvey the most dangerous enemy of the Negro race in America and in the world. With his days of freedom numbered, Garvey struck back against Du Bois and the Talented Tenth when he presided over the UNIA convention that August. His anti-racist affirmations had turned to blisteringly racist ridicule. Black people were the most careless and indifferent people in the world, Garvey proclaimed to thousands at Madison Square Garden. Appeals exhausted. 6 months later, Garvey walked into federal prison, only to be deported 3 years later. Weeks before Garvey's final UNIA convention, delegates gathered for the Democratic National Convention of 1924 at that very same Madison Square Garden. The Democrats came within a single vote of endorsing the anti-black, anti-Catholic, anti-Semitic platform promulgated by the powerful Ku Klux Klan. The platform would have been anti-immigrant, too, if Congress had not passed the Immigration Act on a bipartisan vote earlier in the year. It was authored by Washington State Republican Albert Johnson, who was well-schooled in anti-Asian racist ideas and well-connected to Madison Grant. Politicians seized on the powerful eugenicist demands for immigration restrictions on people from all countries outside of Nordic Northwestern Europe. President Calvin Coolidge, the Massachusetts Republican who replaced Harding after his sudden death in 1923, happily signed the legislation before his re-election. Biological laws tell us that certain divergent people will not mix or blend, Coolidge wrote as vice president-elect in 1921. The Nordics propagate themselves successfully. With other races, the outcome shows deterioration on both sides. After passage of the Immigration Act of 1924, eugenicists quickly turned back to focusing on the segregation of non-Nordics in the United States. Ironically, the act's side effects slowed the pace of the eugenic agenda. The act reduced Nordic fears of non-Nordics taking over the country, and it energized the intellectual struggle of the assimilationists to get non-whites to comply with white ideals of American homogeneity. The Catholic, pro-immigrant Knights of Columbus Historical Commission even financed the publication of several books focusing on the contributions of different racial and ethnic groups. These included The Germans in the Making of America, Since the Germans Were Hated in the Interwar Period, The Jews in the Making of America, and Du Bois's The Gift of Black Folk, The Negro in the Making of America, 1924. Unlike eugenicists and assimilationists, Du Bois desired a multiracial pluralism, where differences were acknowledged, embraced,
and equalized in anti-racist fashion, not graded, suppressed, and ignored. But instead of merely sharing the cultural differences of African-American spirituality, artistry, and music, Du Bois graded black people himself in racist fashion, echoing the view of the nation's leading urban sociologist, Robert Park of the University of Chicago. The Negro was primarily an artist, loving life for its own sake, Park wrote. He is, so to speak, the lady among races, and was interested in physical things rather than subjective states and objects of introspection. Du Bois likewise said the Negro had an unmatched sense of sound and color, along with humility and a certain spiritual joyousness, a sensuous tropical love of life in vivid contrast to the cool and cautious New England reason. After all these years, Du Bois was still helping to reinforce Harriet Beecher Stowe's ideas on the soft black soul and the hard white mind. It seemed that nothing could erase this wholeheartedly racist idea from the mind of W.E.B. Du Bois. And when he attended a historic event in March 1924, Du Bois probably felt that his longtime advocacy of black superior artistic gifts was finally paying off. He had hoped that black artists could use the media and their creativity to persuade away racist ideas. Yet another faint hope in persuasion was about to fail another test. Chapter 26. Media Suasion. On the evening of March 21st, 1924, W.E.B. Du Bois walked into a dazzling artistic gathering at Manhattan's Civic Club. Howard University philosopher Alain Leroy Locke was master of ceremonies. Cultural advancement would prove the key to that reevaluation of the Negro which must precede or accompany any considerable further betterment of race relationships, Locke prophesied in the era's definitive anthology, The New Negro, 1925. He proposed media suasion by our talented groups to persuade away racist ideas. 20-year-old New York University student and poet County Cullen, who was also committed to media suasion, was one of more than a dozen black artists, most notably novelist Jesse Fawcett. Present to meet and receive advice from the talented 10th and the white publishers in attendance that evening. Cullen, who was dating Du Bois's daughter, Yolande, ended the Harlem Renaissance's coming out party in a flurry of poems and ovations. Du Bois helped rouse the Harlem Renaissance artistic movement and was even more instrumental in rousing the activism of new Negro students. They protested against the remnants of the Tuskegee approach to schooling and against the efforts of all historically black colleges that had been set up to train servants in docile cheap labor, as Du Bois said in a critique published in the American Mercury in October 1924. Striking first at Florida A&M in 1923, and then Fisk in 1924, Howard in 1925, and Hampton in 1927, and dozens of other HBCUs in between, new Negro campus activists also protested the rules of morality imposed by the colleges to regulate and civilize the supposed barbaric, oversexed, undisciplined black students and keep them out of harm's way of segregationists. On February 4, 1925, more than 100 Fisk strikers ignored curfew and stormed through campus chanting, "Du Bois, Du Bois, and before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave." By the time the protest fever subsided at the end of the decade, many of the rules had been expunged, and HBCU curricula, aside from a handful of Negro studies courses, were hardly distinguishable from the curricula at historically white colleges and universities, HWCUs. Accommodators and anti-racists were upset, but assimilationists were delighted. A cadre of Harlem's young and talented black artists refused to take direction from W.E.B. Du Bois. They called themselves the Niggerati in 1926, clearly showing little interest in assimilation or in media suasion. The Niggerati included novelist Wallace Thurman, who was best known for his fictional tribute to Dark Beauty, The Black of the Berry, 1929, and Florida native Zora Neale Hurston, who would study with Franz Boas, reject his assimilationism, and become the penultimate anti-racist mouthpiece of rural Southern black culture. These youngsters were formulating a literary and social space of total artistic freedom and tolerance for differences in culture, color, class, gender, race, and sexuality.
The Niggerati was quite possibly the first known fully anti-racist intellectual and artistic group in American history. Its members rejected class racism, cultural racism, historical racism, gender racism, and even queer racism, as some members were homosexual or bisexual. Not that they were bold enough to come out as such. Elaine Leroy Locke, Bessie Smith, and Ma Rainey were among the many Harlem Renaissance headliners leading double lives in closeted homophobic America, privately affirming negated black sexualities as they publicly affirmed black negated artistry. In The Nation in June 1926, a 24-year-old poetic sensation, another headliner who was quite possibly in the sexual closet, laid out the Niggerati's anti-racist philosophy in The Negro Artist and the Racial Mountain.